Hello everyone, I'm Rob Warner.
And I'm Elliot Jackson.
And this is Just Ride from Red Bull. Let's go.
Right, I didn't do the Alps, but I did the Himalayas.
You did the Himalayas on the penny farm.
Yeah.
Just like you do.
To pay for the trips, I literally just sell everything I own. So like the first day of the trip, everything I own in the world pretty much is with me.
What a life.
What a way.
What a life. Are they comfortable?
No, God, no. Oh, God, no. It's uncomfortable on a really good day.
Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Just Ride. I don't even know what to say. You say it. You nailed it.
the way you pushed that out there, it was nothing small about that, mate. There was nothing small about that.
Okay, never again. Never again. Rob, where did we, where did we just come from?
We've been to Chile.
What happened there? What did we do?
Valparaiso, baby. The street race. Round one. Wasn't it good?
Yeah, it was so good. It was so good to be on site. Like that, man, that event, like that format of racing, that like it's South America, the fans, the vibe. It's such a cool thing.
The ferocity of it, I think, is probably... Yeah,
that's a great almost, word. That's a great
word. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's the most... The thing that, you know, when we walk down it and you sort of see how steep it is, just how big the gaps are that everyone's sending up, you know, from concrete to concrete, you know. It's a wild proposition. And the South Americans right now are pretty damn good at it. It was a, you know, it's their downhill. It's like, it's amazing. Yeah. It's downhill racing. It's exactly the same. Every corner, every pedal stroke counts. It's just done on concrete in the wildest environment, you know, the one that we are totally not used to.
Down a city street. Yeah. So like, just in case anyone missed it, you should definitely go and check it out. Red Bull Valparaiso Cerro Bajo is a round one of the street racing series, and we literally go to different cities around the world, find a steep hill, and race from the top to the bottom, downstairs, through houses, you know, all this different stuff. And yeah, like you were saying, Rob, the South Americans, they're like training. You know, when I was doing the research, you see them going, it was crazy because Felipe Gerto, he has this crew of people, and they go to different cities, you know, around where he lives, and they'll put one person at the bottom so they don't get hit by a car. It's kind of like skateboarding or something like that in that way. And it just trained down these sets of stairs, like the tightest, the steepest, the most stairs they can find. And that's what it kind of takes to race those things nowadays. It's almost like their World Cup series.
Yeah, they're specialists, didn't they? Yeah, it's impressive, really impressive to see, isn't it? Just how seriously everyone takes it. And, well, yeah, there's a lot at stake. You know, it's a big Red Bull series. It's like, it's their chance to shine. Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I did. I thought it was absolutely amazing, didn't you?
Yeah, for sure. How did you feel commentating?
I enjoyed it. I mean, we probably at this point now that the show's gone out and it was decent, we can say that there was a few technical issues and that we had no contact with anyone. No headphones worked, no communications worked between anyone from the TV truck that controls us, controls the cameraman, controls the whole thing. They couldn't get a line out, literally.
Yeah.
And I mean, the commentary was, well, we know we're comfortable, but the post show live was interesting.
Yeah, totally.
And I've never been more relieved than when I saw Rhett Risey, our producer, hold up a piece of paper that said, say ciao. That's all we had. We were like, yeah, when's this going to end? It was funny,
totally,
wasn't it?
I was, I was loving it too, because it was like, and then we had one of those moments. I'm like so happy I've had one of those moments in my career now where we said goodbye and we just stayed on camera for like, it felt like an hour. I was like, Rob, we have to like turn around. So I like hit you to turn around and like, you know how the news anchors do the thing where they like shuffle the papers and talk about something or whatever. I was like trying to do that. But then like you said, Risey Risey was giving us cue cards, and I was like, that was a huge mistake, because now I don't know if I'm supposed to say anything. So I was
looking back and forth. You're going to have to have a little look around, which is going to look even stranger. That was uncomfortable, wasn't it? Right. It was an uncomfortable stare down the lens, but we got it done. We got it done, didn't we?
Yeah, it was great.
And it was a brilliant race, an amazing race. Incident-packed, big crashes, great finale. Yeah, it was a great way to start the series.
For sure. I know. I can't wait for the next couple. Well, next one's in Mexico in a couple weeks. But before that, as always, I mean, we're loving hearing from the Just Ride community this year. And the email from Dan Smith really got to us. He said some really, really lovely things about Rachel Atherton. And he said that the interview just captured her personality better than any interviewer he's ever heard with Rach. So thank you so much, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And it's just always brilliant to interview Rachel, because you probably never really meet anyone more open, you know, and to hear her speak. Yeah, that's right. It's incredible. It is. It's someone of her stature and just putting it all out there is always incredible. So yeah, and if you want to get in touch with us about anything else cycling related, then you've only got to email podcast@redbull.com.
And Rob, this week we had someone really special, like actually special, probably it's a one of one person. He rode a Penny Farthing, I didn't actually know what they were called. It's a big front wheel, little back wheel. He'll explain where the name came from. But he came into the studio. He's done some amazing things. It was crazy because we got to have lunch with him, and then he brought the bike in that he rode around the world. Oh. And I took a ride on it. Like, I was like, okay, I'm gonna ride it.
Not unaided. That's just, I think we should be honest.
We need to be honest with
the public here.
I was cracking up because I got on it and I was like, okay, you know, I'm a professional bike rider or whatever. And I felt a little bit uneasy. I couldn't really.
I bet you did.
It's pretty unintuitive. And then I was like, Joff, all right, I got it, mate. Like, you can let go. He's like, oh, no. No, I'm not going to let you go. he's like, this thing is like my wife, man. Like, I'd ridden this thing around the world. And I was like, I don't know if I should take offense to him being like, you're like a child. Like, you can't. There's no way that you can ride this thing without me holding on to you. And I was like, all right. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I guess I don't have it.
He was like a giant stabilizer. But yeah, did he actually let go or not? I don't think he did.
No, he didn't. He never let go.
Well, that's his baby.
Yeah, for sure. No, it was great. It was so cool to meet him in person, huh?
Hey, what a dude he was. Big wheeler incoming. This is incredible.
Yeah, you guys are going to enjoy this. Well, without further ado, let's get into the episode.
Well, today's guest has ridden around the world, not on a mountain bike, not on a road bike, not on a gravel bike, but on a flipping Penny Farthing. There it is over there. And to make it even more incredible, you actually built it yourself. We can't wait to get stuck into this one. Welcome to Just Ride, Joff Summerfield. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
You rode in, right?
I did, yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah, only from London Bridge, but it's not that far.
It's like, do you have a car?
I've got an old sort of 1970s camper van.
Commuter
bike.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a struggle to get it in the lift with six people. Get it up here this morning.
Wait, Joff. So I didn't actually know what a penny farthing is. Like what? Describe what it is. I mean, it's just there, but describe what it is and why is it called a penny farthing?
Well, it's called a penny farthing because in the period, sort of like the 1870s, 1880s, the penny was a large coin, British coin, and a farthing was a small coin. So it was a kind of a slang name, and so that's what they were called, penny farthings. I mean, they were also called ordinary bikes because they were the ordinary type of bike.
Right.
And when the modern diamond frame bike that you guys all ride came out, they were called safety bikes because they were so much safer.
No way.
Yeah, that's how it all came out.
Safety bike. What, that?
No, the real ones, those were the bikes for losers. Like.
So the diamond frames and pneumatic tyres, I say, which is a passing fad, I'm still sure. They all came out. Yeah, only pneumatic tyres. It's just like solid rubber tyres. That's where they all came from. So there's no air in the tyres as well. So it's a very basic machine, but it works. And it's, also, they're pretty much an accident waiting to happen. But
I was going to say that as well, because you're quite a long way off the ground up there.
Yeah, it looks a lot bigger than...
What is that diameter of that front wheel?
This one's like a 49-inch.
And that's your gear as well, right?
That's the gear, yeah. So that's where the gearing that you guys will still use come from Penny Farthing.
We hit a lever, you change a wheel.
Exactly.
What do you mean, like gear ratio? Like,
yeah, gear ratio is you doing inches, and it comes from Penny Farthings.
If you've got a smaller front wheel, the gearing's higher, you go faster.
That's slow.
So here, because right, it's like a big
right on.
Big gear.
Is that?
Yep.
Right on. No, I'm not arguing. No, why? So if you want to do a steep climb, you would put a smaller wheel.
Smaller
in.
Wheel, yeah, and smaller wheel and longer cranks. That's the only way you've got. Like on the racing ones, then you go bigger and bigger, but the cranks have to be smaller because your legs aren't long enough. You run out of leg length in the end.
To reach the centre of the...
So you really, if you're racing, like you just run the biggest wheel you possibly can.
Yeah, that you can fit.
So would I do well being 6'4" then?
Oh, you'd be good.
I could run a massive front wheel.
Yeah. I would say the acceleration at the corners, though, depends on the course.
I feel like come back with races on the cards.
Yeah,
here.
Sign you up. Totally.
What's like the biggest one you've heard of?
I mean, they went up to like 60-inch, but you had to be super long inside leg to be able to ride.
Yeah, because I guess you can't turn either.
No, when you turn, what happens? It has got, when you're pushing it, a wide turning circle. When you're riding it, because the wheel comes out and it burns the inside of your leg.
Right.
So you always know when not to stop turning. Because you the burning sensation, you smell the smell of your flesh burning on the inside of your leg. So
is that how it is?
Yeah. But it makes you stronger. You know,
it's an unbelievable. It's so simple and so beautiful, isn't it? I mean, is that the first bicycle in existence then?
No. So before these, it was what the dandies would ride. So they were like a wooden bike, iron.
Upper class people.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
Is that right?
That's it. And they would scoot along and then they wanted to start pedaling. So they put cranks on the front and then realised, well, hang on, we can't go very fast because they were very small wheels. So the only way to gearing change was to make the front wheel bigger, and they kind of rubber tyres came out, and they kind of, it was an evolution. So they gradually got bigger and bigger and bigger, and simple as that.
Well, okay, what was your introduction to it? Did you, I know you started building them, but was that the first time you're like, this thing is beautiful, I got to build one, or do you start riding them first?
No, it came sort of a long way around. So my background, originally, it was motorsport. Motor racing from like 18, I was racing around Silverstone, and then I ended up as a race engine builder, ended up in Formula One, but always planned on working for myself. Right. So when I first started working for myself, suddenly I didn't have a paycheck anymore, and it was like, oh, this is a bit hard. So for a holiday, I had an old pre-war BSA paratroopers bike, which is a folding bike, and I rode that up to Amsterdam. I had a great time, and I thought, this is how I'm going to see the world on a bike. And I was never a cyclist. And, but I like making stuff. So I thought, what's the silliest thing I could think of, which was a penny farthing. So I went along to a museum.
Went to a lot of museums. Is that what your research was it?
Yeah, I just went to a museum. Oh, no, only one. And it was, measured them up and made one and rode that to Paris for the Millennium. And the first one, well, I totally over-engineered. So I built it around a Sturmey Archer 3-speed hub where a leaf spring suspension, but it weighed... I think it was 76 pounds. So it weighed an absolute ton.
Couldn't have been much fun uphill.
Oh, it was awful. Absolutely bloody awful.
Did you like the gears on it? Was that
it's a complete waste of time.
Was it?
Yeah. Because the issue was as well, because they're on the Sturmey Archer hub, the sprocket's on one side, so you have to get the power to your pedal on the other side. So I had to run on a chain up the forks, cross the top, back down the other side. It wasn't very efficient.
Yeah. No.
And I just got to Paris with 5 minutes to spare for the Millennium celebration.
Where did you come from the UK?
Yeah. So I was only on the road.
Was that the first ride that you did? Like,
pretty
you
much, like, yeah. No, I'd never ridden one before I built one. The first one I ever rode was the one I made. And after going to the messing around making it and riding it, thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Right, persevere. And on the first day in France, I knew I couldn't ride that particular bike around the world. And I stopped in a little sort of cafe and I stayed there and I just like, oh my God, this is terrible. It's not, all my dreams are gone. And I wrote down, right, this is a list of things I've got to change to make this happen. Went off. Oh, 8 years later, coming back from my trip around the world, having nearly completed it, came down a hill and like, oh, thirsty. Oh, I've got to dive in this calf. Went into this calf, sat down and like, shit, this is the same calf, no just by way. Chance.
Holy cow.
And I said to the patron, oh, you probably remember me with a penny farthing. He'd like, no, bought it a year ago. No, it's like, oh, okay, I won't, never mind. Yeah. But it was the same calf. And it's like, wow, here I am again, having completed it finally. And it's, so which is cool, which is really cool. But they are mad. But then I made another one.
I still did. Still processing it.
Feels like it escalated really quickly. Yeah.
So then I did, made so 8 years later, he's back. Yeah. Like, yeah. Just going out of shops 8 years later. It sounds like an Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah.
He disappeared for a few years.
Well, I see. It's good to disappear. But then I did made another bike with all the corrections. I did land into John O'Groats on that one.
Did you?
Yeah, that's.
Do you take different size wheels then for the climbs?
No, just one size.
So like we hook them on the sides, yeah. Or something.
Luggage packing is a bit of an issue, as it is, to be honest.
It's a little bit big.
Yeah. Carrying another wheel would be
You really are. That's what you take, what you got then. That's
yeah. So it. on here, so I have another of these red panniers below, and a small front bag, and I had a small backpack for cameras and stuff. Just because you can't carry anything electronic in the bags, because the vibrations from the tires, solid tires and stuff, just destroys anything electronic. So,
honestly,
so it's
so it's not like it's not. Is it? Are they comfortable?
No, God no. Oh God no. It's uncomfortable on a really good day, and then it goes downhill from there, pretty much. So it's not comfortable, but it makes you feel alive.
Yeah.
How many
have you built?
Probably customer bites, 50 or 60 probably in total over the years.
What do you think's harder, building a penny farthing or an F1 engine?
The F1 engine.
Oh, okay.
Because one tiny mistake, and then
I
the thing explodes.
I love that you had to think about it a little bit.
What did you do in F1 then? Just, you actually, designed engines or?
No. So I worked for a company called Brian Hartz, and so that was all in the 90s. And we built engines for Jordan when they started, Arrows, Minardi, sort of the midfield teams. No, and I was there for 5 years. It's great.
And like the transition from making one of the most complicated high performance engineering feats on earth, an F1 engine, to one of the simplest, I can't make that connection myself.
There's a transition. So when I started working for myself, that was doing the race engines as well. And and it gradually just kind of went more onto the bikes, and I do other craft stuff as well. I've got a stall on the market in Covent Garden, which is great. And you kind of vicariously travel through that. So it's just like, you only get one life, and I just want to change my hat, a bit like the old Wurzel Gummidge thing, change the head, have a different experience and just keep on changing. Why not? You know,
that's right.
Yeah, we're very privileged. You know, we've got great passports, you know, use them, and see different stuff.
So on your around the world trip then, where did you go through the Alps or what? Did you go through the mountains?
What was the route?
What was the route?
So I started in London.
I just can't imagine that in the Alps or something. Yeah. Like up or down.
Yeah.
Down.
A country by country. So I started in London, went across Europe, and down through sort of Holland, Germany, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Serbia, Macedonia, Greece, into Istanbul, then zigzagged my way across Turkey and to the border with Iran. Unfortunately, my original plan had then to be across Iran and Pakistan, India, but in eastern Turkey got dysentery, so I'd run out of water one day, and I started hallucinating. I tried sucking a rock as well, which helps you quench your thirst. It helps, an old Victorian thing. If you suck a rock, if you're out of water to help when you're going bonkers because you can't drink any water, suck a rock and it
any
helps.
Rock.
Well, not a really big one.
Sandstone, granite.
Like 3/4 inch, I reckon. That's what I recommend. Yeah, not
like lozenge.
Yeah, lozenge. Large lozenge. Small. Yeah, signed, not rough. Not sandy.
Smooth.
Yeah, something smooth. Well,
just get it in there.
Put it in there. Yeah, yeah. Don't chew it. Like to rinse teeth. You know, but it's.
How does that rehydrate you?
Don't know. It didn't work. I was still really thirsty. So I'd read this because I love the old sort of Victorian sort of travel books, and And I'd read that in there. I thought, I'll give that a go. And but no, it didn't really work. But I tried two to see if that would double it, but it didn't. That didn't work.
Have you got a, like, it sounds like you might have a mad interest in a Victorian time. Is it,
yeah.
Because that was the Industrial Revolution, wasn't
it? Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, the amazing engineering period where they thought everything was possible.
Stevenson. Yeah, that's is that right? With the trains and
that's
that,
it.
Right?
Yeah, Robert Louis Stevenson. Yeah, that's the rocket. And it's just an amazing time. And adventure then was still proper adventure. Sure. You know, when they were going off, it was like, well, see ya.
Yeah.
You're not getting an email. You might get a cool
jump in
letter.
A balloon, come back 80 days later, all that sort of thing.
Absolutely,
is that what inspired you to kind of live this life? Because you don't, you did the around the world, but like you also take these insane adventures where you sell everything.
Oh yes, that's what the around the world. So to pay for the trips, I've never had sponsors or anything, no support. I literally just sell everything I own. And so like the first day of the trip, everything I own in the world pretty much is with me on that. And
You just sold everything else off?
Yeah, just get rid of it. Well, yeah, you don't need this baggage and crap, you know, just sell it, get rid of it. And then everything I own is on there. There was a few sort of sentimental things, I mean, loft to be parents and stuff, but no, that's it. And it's so refreshing. And it's like, no one's going to send me a bill, you know. And it's great. And
what a way to actually that is, live your life. Super cool.
Yeah. And then I didn't, I mean, all the trips so far, I've never taken a phone or anything like that.
Wow.
So you go and
no one can get hold of you.
No, it's great. I know, it's so good. Isn't it? Yeah. You can still go in internet cafes and stuff.
Do you plan it out? Like, are you like, oh, I'm going to take this road? Or you just
the whole planning thing is just, it's like, no, do it on the day, you know. Right. So you get the map out in the pub before you go. I was like, well, that's the world. I'm going to head east. Well, that's that done. That's drinking time, isn't it?
I need to go that way.
Yeah. You know, and
head east. The direction? Or?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I've got no sense of direction. So I carry like two or three compasses and take the average and then ignore the first one because I'm probably going to go with that. But I'm probably going to be wrong. So I should go the opposite to what I actually think.
Do compasses give different readings then?
Well, the cheap ones, yeah. I'm a bit tight one.
Do they really?
Yeah, the cheap ones. Yeah. So it's... So it's they can all vary, and it's thing is, you've got the time. It doesn't matter if you get lost, does it? You know, if the wind's blowing that way, I'll try and go that way if I can. And you know, following the sun's pretty good as well. That's kind of good. So.
And so, how many miles do you have on that bike?
I've got it in my pocket still. I'm a man of precision. So that has got on it. That's me. There you go. Let's click through. It's got. 37,497 miles on the
clock. That's more than my car.
That's like around the world twice then? Or
yeah,
like
well,
the
done
equivalent?
Twice.
Oh, you've done it twice.
Yeah, so I left... the first one I left in beginning of 2006, got back at the end of 2008. And then in 2014, I was stuck and getting itchy feet again. And so I thought I'd do it again, but the other way around. Hmm. And so I started that trip in Toronto, but that ended in Ecuador. So I only actually got halfway around that time. So,
you have a story about Ecuador, right?
Yeah. It was. I mean, Ecuador is an amazing country.
Did you see Cotopaxi?
I think I did.
What is that?
Just a volcano I like.
Oh yes, the volcanoes. Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Highest vertical drop in the world in Ecuador for the mountains.
Oh, was it? Right,
apparently,
okay.
Someone told me that, yeah, the
wow.
other day.
Oh, right, okay. Mm. Oh, because I came down from Quito down to the coast, and that was just going on and on and on and on.
Yeah. It's on. Apparently, the Earth bulges there because it's the
equator.
Yeah, and the actual force of the centrifugal force makes the Earth swell at those points. And I think one of the mountains is taller from sea. It's bigger than an Everest, but it's not quite something. Anyway, let's move on. It's a cycling podcast.
I'll take it.
It's something like that. Yeah.
I think I saw it. I know it's a big mountain.
Can't miss it.
It's another big mountain. So it's Ecuador. I got robbed in Ecuador, so that's why that's why I bought that trip to an end. To say it's not a reflection on Ecuador because the people were lovely, amazing. It's just a reflection on those couple of people there.
And
I camped off. I mean, because I free camp all the time. So if I come to a city, I stay in a hostel. But otherwise, I just free camp all the time.
And just lock that up outside on the rack.
I don't lock it. I mean, just to a tree or something. And
if somebody tried to ride that, they wouldn't get far.
Well,
anyway.
And if they did, I'd know who they were. So it's kind of that's the good thing about that. But I just camped in a it was a banana plantation, and seemed like a really nice spot. And then I saw a couple of people come in from the road. So it was way back from the road. And the owner, and I have a black tent as well, just so it's disguised, because you get loads of attention during the day. You don't want any attention during the night. You just want to chill out and relax and just write your journal and stuff.
Yeah.
And these guys came in off from a motorbike, and I thought they were farmers. Yeah. And they came up to the tent, and they'd been tracking me. And one of them pulled out a gun. They dragged me out of the tent, so a gun in my face, and basically robbed me of everything.
I suppose your passport was probably their most...
Well, they didn't take... That's the one good thing they didn't take, because they were after... I had a little laptop with me, all my cameras, and a load of camera gear. So the only thing they didn't take was the bike and the tent. So they took my glasses, my shoes, all my clothes, other than ones I was wearing.
They didn't take the bike?
It would have been a decision to make then, if they were going to take, because they tied me up and everything, and they tied me up and then you know, and when they found my credit card, they wanted the number, and of course you can't just give them a number because they think you're going to lie. Obviously you are going to lie, but you have to resist that for a bit. And so you had the gun on the temple kind of thing, and sort of a bit roughed up, and so gave him a fake number, which is a bit of a gamble because I didn't know how close the nearest place was.
Because they could have took you there.
They would have gone there and then come back
because he's tied up.
So I didn't, because there's two of them.
They tied you up so you couldn't move.
Wrist and ankles. But when they tie you up, when they're tying you, you twist it so it actually feels a bit tighter. So it looks tight, and you go,
know all of this?
Well, I was going to ask that as well. Were you ex-SAS?
No, it's you've got a brother. So when you're kids, you tie each other up. And it's like, and I was the younger one, so I was the one that's tied up.
Yeah.
And so you twist it and you pretend it's tight, and you make a note like it hurts.
Yeah.
So then you can go like that, twist back, and then it's loose and you get undone. So I knew I could get undone.
Okay.
But because there was two of them, I was wondering, will one stay and one go and get the money and stuff? But they'd done so well out of me already. But then at the end of it, because I was looking at their faces, one guy had really distinctive face tattoos as well, easily recognising.
Did he?
And they put a hood over my jacket, wrapped it around my head, and they kneeled on me and put the gun to my head. And I thought, oh shit, this isn't good.
What?
And so you just keep talking. And it's like I read Darren Brown's book. And he explained a thing when he left a nightclub or something, someone was going to mug him. And the natural progression is or you fight, or you run, or you do something.
Yeah.
You break that theme.
Okay.
And he said, oh, red shoes. Oh, amazing shoes. And started talking about this guy's red shoes. And it totally broke the theme of what this guy was expecting to do. Completely threw him. So, and I always remembered that. And at this point, it was like, just stay calm. Just keep talking to make yourself look, still seem like a human. And like, no problem. Yeah, you take it all. You're scumbags. I'll work hard and buy new stuff. And just don't take my bike. That's the key thing. And it just, you know, they're discussing it. One, the guy with the gun was an old guy. The younger guy was obviously a bit more reticent about shooting me in the head. So so thankfully they didn't, and they just left. And but that brought that trip to the end.
You've spoken ever so lightly about it there, considering what happened. Did it affect you afterwards for a while?
Yeah,
put you off sort of sleeping out in the middle of nowhere?
Not really. No, I mean, at the time good. I was kind of like, right, no, this is... time to go home, lick the wounds, and because to replace everything would have done the rest of my budget anyway. And I wouldn't have been, certainly in that area, I've been happy sort of camping still. It's only like it's 99.9% of the people in the world are absolutely amazing. They'll give you their last grain of rice if they can. Was just by that stage I'd been on the road like 4.5 years in total with the two trips. It's kind of like, well, you know, you've got to meet them some stage. It's life experience, makes you stronger. Move on. Don't want to do it again. Thanks very much. But it's not a reflection on traveling.
Totally.
People are lovely. People are amazing.
They are.
You know.
That's absolutely true.
Speaking about the other side of that, I'm sure you've had like so many amazingly positive experiences. Do you reflect on like a top three or top five or like?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the route, I didn't do the Alps, but I did the Himalayas. So I went from...
You did the Himalayas on the penny farthing.
Yeah, so I came in from China and...
like you do.
And through Tibet, which was my favourite country. Because it was the hardest, because I had to enter illegally. Because you couldn't get to... You can't independently travel there.
Oh, really?
At the time, certainly.
No, is that right?
Yeah, so you can go in. You can go in on the plane. So you can fly into Lhasa, or you can go in on the train, which goes north, and they give you an alien travel permit. But with just my normal visa, I couldn't get one of those because they don't want independent travellers there. So I went to the border. Just they had like these little sheds, like garden sheds there. Essentially, it was a real rough border, and they came out, and I had to fill out a form and saying, and Yunnan province was to the south, but I wanted to go west. And I said, Yunnan, oh yeah, yeah. Then I got up at 3 a.m. and packed up, and then snuck under the barrier whilst they were asleep and got into Tibet. And and then you have to do that on all the checkpoints as well. So there's about 5 or 6 checkpoints between.
Hard to spot though. Yeah. You see it seamlessly blended in.
Yeah,
with the locals.
That's it. Yeah.
20 foot above them.
Yeah. Morning.
So in the day, how did you move about then? No one bothered you in the day.
No, well, on the road, there's like literally one road from Chengdu in China to Lhasa. And so when you can figure out where the checkpoints are, and it's good because they have kilometre markers on the side of the road, so you know exactly where they are. You can get kind of information on that. So then you just camp before you get there. If you, because they have all the army convoys there.
They won't bother you if they see you on the road.
No.
It's just at the checkpoint.
Well, it's that communist mentality. They're told to guard that checkpoint.
Sure.
They're not told to guard 10 feet there or 10 feet on either side. They're told to guard that, not let you through. So as long as you get either side, you're fine. And as well, when the convoys were coming through, because there's no trees, because you're at altitude, you can't hide. And obviously, if you're hiding and they spot you, you look guilty. So I discovered that people always think you're going in the direction the bike's pointing. So if I saw one coming, I'd turn the bike around, point it back towards China, so I looked like I was leaving Tibet, which is what they want. And he must be legally here because he's here. And then have a drink and wave at him.
And that worked all the way through Tibet. And you got out the other side, all good.
Yeah. But the checkpoints. I mean,
never heard anyone hide in plain sight like that, riding through Tibet illegally on a penny farthing. What's going on?
I feel like I want to come back to like these beautiful moments, but like the last couple of stories you've told, you have like the most street smarts I've ever heard of. Like what's the best survival tip that you know?
I think it's not street smarts, it's street dumb. I'm sure it'd be all right. No, no. Outlook on life. The best thing you can carry for traveling, that weighs nothing, everyone's got one, is a smile. And just carry that, and that gets you out of so much trouble.
Sure.
And just smile, you know, and just keep smiling.
Be harmless. Because you ain't doing nothing wrong, are you?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you're supposed to be here.
Yeah.
You know, oh, really? I'm not supposed to be in Tibet. Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I do, but like, you know. And it's, I mean, you've got to take chances. I mean, later on that route, it was the checkpoint. It was over the Salween River. And I came, so again, middle of the night. And they have the old checkpoint Charlie barriers over the roads. And of course, it's pitch black because there's no street lights. So it's not a tarmac road. It's a single track dirt road. And came up, walked up to the barrier, tiptoeing because there's loads of dogs around. You don't want to wake the dogs up as well because they'll start howling and barking. And so tipped up and just getting the bike under the barrier. And then I noticed there was a soldier standing up the other side of the road on the barrier with his gun like sleeping. And like, oh shit, you know. Don't wake him up. And because this is a pain in the ass to get under a barrier. And they get it under there and then get across. And I'm thinking, yes. He didn't wake up. And I went across the bridge, all full of myself.
You got back on, did you?
Oh, no, it's only short. Walked across. Yeah, because it's pitch black then. It's just like, And across to the other side. And of course, there's another barrier. And stupidly, like bridges are barriers at both ends. And came to the other end, and because you only see it because it's literally pitch black, you can't use any lights because you wake him up.
Yeah.
There was another soldier, and he was like as close to you as you are to me right now. And I was like, and he was sleeping with his gun on his shoulder. I was like,
Stood up.
Yeah, still, yeah, just standing there, like leaning against the fence, like snoozing. And it was kind of like, shit. And trying to get it under without waking him up. It's very tempting to get a selfie, but cool. That would have been great. But I mean, if I would see him and I'd woken up and seen me, I definitely would have shot me and thrown me in the river.
Is that actually what would have happened?
I don't know. I wasn't going to ask him to find out.
You would be, you'd be in big trouble.
To wake a soldier up when he's sleeping at night.
Yeah. And through his barrier.
Yeah, yeah. And it's probably not a good thing to do. But it was...
that sounds real risky.
Well, it didn't. Well, I mean, you just get used to it. You know, it's just. It's, I mean, it's not really.
It's living. It's,
yeah, well, living. That's it. That's
it's
it.
Living. You know? I'll give you that, man.
But then, and the other checkpoints were just middle of the night ones, and no one around. That was the nearest miss on that trip, for the thing. But back to your previous question, that for the lovely people. I mean, again in Tibet, because it was the most extreme. Mm. I mean, and just the mountains going. I mean, I could go down the mountains, but I couldn't ride them up. And it would take like 2 days to push it after a 5,000 meter pass. And then they're all the way down to 2,000 meters, then have to push it all the days up again.
Wow.
And do you take your feet off on the way down?
Yeah. So you've got a choice. You can hang your legs down.
Yeah.
But these are like 30 mile downhills. But what happens, because the cranks are spinning, they crack you in the shins.
Oh.
So the safe way is to put your legs up on top of the bars. So when you have your accident...
Make it even more dangerous.
The handlebars are really high.
Yeah, but you swing them up onto the top. So it's just on the top there.
Have you got the picture in your head that I am? bloke hurling down the side of the Himalayas.
Is that like classic, like, you know, penny farthing style?
Yeah, well, because if you have your legs hanging down, when you have your accident... Because the bars... Because the bars across your lap, you pivot over the front and it slaps you down. The back wheel lifts off and it slaps you face first. So you break your wrists first, your elbows, and then your teeth.
If your feet are there, you're in the perfect position.
Yeah, well, you start running in midair. And,
you had some high-speed get-offs then?
Not with the legs on the top, with them hanging down, yes. Yeah, so it's...
have you broke many bones on one?
Well, fractured... Both wrists 4 times, both elbows 4 times.
Was this part? Did you ever break anything while you were doing the around the world?
I did. Fractured a wrist in New Zealand. Got hit by a lorry in New Zealand. He just clipped me, and it was quite funny because he clipped me, and then I went off to the road, and there was a big like stop sign there, and I just hit it straight in the face, and fractured my wrist. I'd done it before. I knew what it was. And, shit! And I lifted the bike up, and it was right on the coast. And I had all my journal on the top, and that had come loose, and it fell off and straight down into the river. It was in a waterproof bag, the sea, not the river. And, I got a fractured wrist. I had to run 100 yards up the road, climb down these rocks, wade back along to retrieve my journal, because that's can't lose that, and come back again. But that was the only, I mean, bumps and scrapes and stuff, but that was the only sort of fracture I got on that trip. So, which was
that is so cool. But, have you ever thought about turning the journal into a book?
Yes. It's everyone nags me about it. And I mean, I've got 250,000 words in the journal.
Yeah.
I mean, I journal all the time. So I've started. I mean, it's no need to rush these things.
What would the theme be? Like, would it be something you've learned? Would it just be about the experience?
Just the experience. So because just to show it's possible.
Yeah.
You know, and how you evolve as you're traveling along, because you know, it's when you leave, you've got no idea about what's going to happen. You've read other people's stuff, but you know, they go on different days, different times, different machines, just to prove that anyone can do these things. There's nothing special about, you know, I want to be humble about this, and it's just like, this is an incredible adventure I had, amazing, life-changing. But anyone could have done it. Mm. You know, I just chose to do it. You know, and it's, you know, absolutely. Nothing's impossible.
Yeah. What do you think makes a good adventure?
The further away you go, I think, for me now, the better it is. And just the experiences, meeting people when it's tough, you know, and I say, like in the Himalayas, you always go back to there a lot, because going up at the top of the mountains, you're like 10 foot, push it for 10 steps, then have to take a breath.
Because of the altitude.
Mm. And then 10 steps, and then 10 steps. But then it's like a metaphor in life, because you see the prayer flags at the tops of the passes. And then, you know, after that, you're going to have this amazing downhill. So it's good. Life's tough, but you know it's going to be all right, you know. And it's really cool, you know, and that's a good metaphor for life.
Have you had any moments where you've kind of feared for you, apart from having a gun put to your head, but like, you know, like physically, where you've just been so exhausted? Because... Mm. You know, you're still riding a bicycle. It's more difficult than riding a bike with gears. It's not got the efficiency of a modern day road bike or anything, has it?
No,
you know what I mean?
And
you're going around the world on it through the mountains. I can't really understand it.
I mean, the toughest, I mean, again, as I say, is the Himalayas, because there's no way out. You know, if you're like, I can't go to the local station and get on a train, because there isn't a local station. It's just this road. And I mean, literally those 10 steps and have to take a breath, I was in tears. Just because of the exhaustion and the lack of altitude, the lack of oxygen. And and it's just crazy, crazy tough. And but then you get the downhill and you get past it, and it's just it's a massively tough, and you have to dig deep, and it's this because there isn't, you can't give in and go home.
No, that's right.
You have to keep going, and it's kind of and that's great, you know, that's brilliant. And then you get, I think one of the passes, it was absolutely super, super tough. And then that night I came down a bit and it was sleeting and snowing, and the hands were absolutely frozen, and I got in the tent, and so I always keep one set of dry clothes so I can wear dry clothes in the tent. And and but then the next morning it was still sleeting and snowing. You have to put your wet clothes back on, which is horrendous. And
they're freezing cold.
And they're freezing cold.
Are you serious?
Because you can't, because you don't know what you're going to do in the next night. So you always have to keep some dry ones in the tent.
Right.
And I put the gloves on, and after about 10 minutes, I couldn't, my fat hands were just totally numb. I couldn't hold the bars.
What?
So I had to start walking. And I mean, it was rideable, but I couldn't hold the bars. But then it was like a little Tibetan villager's hut. So they're like compacted earth huts, no real windows. And I could see the smoke coming out. So I knew there's some people in there. And I banged on the door with my elbow. And then the door opened, and there's this family in this one-roomed sort of house. Yeah. But they have the stove there. And then knew exactly what was wrong. They pulled me in, pulled my gloves off, put my gloves on there, dried me out, gave me jam jars of hot water. It's just amazing. And that's the experience. Yeah, it's just like, wow,
you
humanity.
Won't get any other way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? It's, like, that's it. And it's just, you know, and it's just, they knew what was wrong. Wow. And they, you know, saved my bacon that day. And it was, and I left there with just like, after a massively tough day the day before, horrible night, you know, and frozen in the morning, and then dried out and on my way again, you know, and such generosity, you know, of just spirit, not material things,
no,
you know, and it's
right.
all,
beautiful.
You know, and that's out there everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, which is
that's
so cool.
Amazing.
You know, so nice for people.
I have an idea, actually. I want to quiz you, Rob, on some Penny Farthing records.
Oh, he snuck this up on me.
I'm actually fascinated
to
know.
Ask me first.
Yeah,
and then we'll ask you, John. You're going to know a lot more.
Okay, let's see. So, well, first, before I get into all these records that I have, are like 1890s. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the main Penny Farthing period was the 1880s, and the end of that.
Yeah.
That's when the sort of modern safety bike came out. So a few manufacturers hung on for a little bit, but they all swapped over.
But nobody obviously there's a couple of records that have been broken, but like,
mainly they all stand.
Yeah. Wow.
Just quickly, are there any brands from that era that made Penny Farthings that still exist now as bicycle brands then? Not really. Was it just a British thing, this?
Well, a lot of
or
the
was
car,
it global, Penny Farthings?
I mean, I was global.
It was.
It was British and then America mainly.
Is that right?
And then some European ones, but mainly British and American.
Huh.
I mean, a lot of the bike brands became car manufacturers.
That's right, that would have been the next step.
And they conglomerated into the sort of the global companies now. So they're all sort of like the old car became British Leyland, but they were all bicycle manufacturers first. Yeah. They
That's
were
crazy.
Mostly,
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So now that I know my records are actually valid, because these 1886, 1880. Okay. Rob, which one do I want? What is the fastest 100-kilometer ride on a Penny Farthing?
I'm going to say 3 hours.
Joff, do you know?
That's a good guess, actually. I would say 21.
I hate him already.
It's 3 hours and 11 minutes.
Oh, that was pretty good.
By Paul Lienert in Germany. 1886, July.
1886. Imagine what he was wearing.
Oh, 1896, sorry.
Imagine what he had on.
Yeah, so
probably a woolen suit, right?
Like you were saying, like you would wear wool on the inside of your legs, that way you could turn and...
Yeah, I mean,
it's actually a functional thing.
They would wear wool all the time.
Oh, they had riding gear?
These were athletes at the time. They were proper athletes.
Honestly,
yeah. I mean, you can't try and...
I thought it was just... posh people getting on
the
Penny Farthings and having a go.
No.
Is that right? It was like a sport then.
Hugely, yeah.
The one that I was thinking of, the one that was super impressive to me was what's the fastest, like how long did it take somebody to do the fastest mile on a Penny Farthing? What do you think, Rob?
How long did it take them to do the fastest mile?
Yeah, like time-wise, fastest mile.
Oh, Well, we know the average speed's about 20 mile an hour. Mm. Oh, 3 minutes.
Okay. What do you think, Jaff?
2:50.
Oh, he's
one.
A-
Man, 2:15.
Ah. Oh.
Whoa, so they were moving. Yeah, then. Yeah. Like when they sprinted, like, they were going.
That's like, what, like a little under 30 miles an hour on one of those?
That's right.
That's I mean, that's a big wheel as well.
And, so the fella would have probably been quite tall. Otherwise, he would have been out of reach the bottom of the crane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah.
So for once ever, it seems like penny farthing riding for bicycle riding would have been advantageous to be tall.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Just saying. You're going to look back at this list.
Look back at this list and it'll be like, Rob Warner. Rob Warner.
Yeah, well, it's not until it's over.
They were the real athletes of the time, though.
I mean, right.
They were like heroes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Newspapers talked about them and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the Land's End to John O'Groats record, that stood for about 120 years, and it was only broken a few years ago. Not by much, by Richard Thorday.
No.
And, and he, if I remember rightly, Richard had the tandem end-to-end record for a bit as well. And he's a super cyclist, and they only just broke it.
That's kind of hard to believe in many ways, right?
At the time as well, I don't know how much drugs they were taking. You know, it was common thing to do at the time
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't have helped him in the mile, but for the longer events, stimulants to stay awake and stuff.
Sleep,
yeah, yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah. So,
Somebody, I just want to ask you as well, because you come from making Formula One engines and now you make penny farthings. Like, obviously, the wheel we've spoken about as one of the big factors in regulating the speed, whatever. But, like, is there any differences in geometry? Because it looks like a headset, a set of forks, and then just one bendy tube. I mean, it looks like absolutely the best engineering of a bicycle you could ever imagine.
Super simple. Super simple.
Can you tweak that? Do you tweak that? Is there things you can do or make it handle better or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I tried when I first started making them different sort of head angles and stuff. And I had like an adjustable rear, so I could raise and lower that up, so which would automatically change the front.
Well,
and it didn't seem to make a lot of difference at all. So I just
It didn't.
I mean, I'm not very sensitive, so maybe that's just what it was.
Huh.
And, but the rake on a normal bike's huge, but perhaps it isn't on a.
Well, you want it to be less on this because when you're pedaling, if there's a lot of rake, then it turns the bars. So you want to be vertically above, so all the force goes down and goes into turning the wheel, not turning. Sort of moving any stuff around.
Huh.
So this is like 6 degrees. So it's
It is just 6 degrees. If you hit the front brake, you're in big trouble.
Oh yeah, I say the brakes are literally for moderating speed. They're not. You don't. I mean, I've got brakes on this because of touring for moderating speeds going down mountains. The bikes I make, I don't put brakes on because if it's just and people ask them, I said no, I won't put them on because
it's dangerous.
Oh yeah, because if you grab the brake, there's no weight on the rear wheel. It just literally. Chucks you off the front.
Wow.
I mean, in China, I was going up a hill and I was grinding away up a hill and a girl stepped out in front of me and there was like cars moving that way and there's parked cars all there, all solid things to hit. So I had the choice, well, I'm not going to use the brakes because I'm going to fall off. So I ran her over and it was a soft landing and, you know, I wasn't hurt. She was not too badly hurt and didn't hit anything hard.
Too bad.
And I mean, she got up.
Right.
Yeah, and she had a big tire track down a nice crisp white shirt.
She ran someone over on a penny farthing.
Yeah.
Did they not support you?
No, she was grateful, I think.
I just have this image of Joff being like, what can you do?
I mean, she learned an important lesson in life, you know, that always look when you cross the road. It could have been a motorbike, you know, and that would really hurt
her,
you know, and I wasn't going very fast because I was going uphill. So it was, so everyone won really on that day, you know, and she's got a great story as well.
I can't imagine what you would have looked like riding through China. Or what is going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great because, you know, there's all these little small, because once you're out of the big cities, then it's all just small villages and you're just like, oh my God, you're like an alien turning out there, which is great. It's amazing.
Towering above them on a bike.
That's it. And there's all these little cafes but just rooms with restaurants and stuff. The food's great. And
it's
dirt cheap, absolute dirt cheap.
Right.
And you just go in and pantomime what you want, point to what other people are eating, or just go in the kitchen, lift the things, make animal noises. and just going on all these little cast meetings, so many people, and really curious. And I carried a little A4 map of the world, which I drew a line on, so I could show them where I come from on a map.
Yeah.
I'm going to. Yeah, and they could all understand that. And that was so cool.
Wow.
I mean, in one of the little restaurants, I went in one day, and normally they have a window, but it didn't have a window. So I wheeled my bike in there, leant against the wall, and because they don't have signs or anything like that. And but you can tell they're restaurants, everyone knows they are. And they're all just like startled. So I was like, sort of, you know, did the pantomime for can I have some food, please?
Yeah.
And the lady was rolling out some noodles on the side. And so, oh, that'd be good. So she made like a noodle soup and everything. And they all like very curious and showed them the map and everything. And when I went to leave, it was, they looked a bit puzzled about charging me. And like, then I had to look around, hang on. Oh shit, this isn't a restaurant, this is someone's house. And I walked into someone's house with a penny farthing, a Colonial Pith helmet, and demanded food, and they'd fed me, and had been absolutely amazing.
Oh my word!
It was so nice, and I was so embarrassed. Like, oh, thank you. So I gave them like double what I'd normally pay, and they were like, oh, no, please, please. And they all waved me off down the road, and it was such a nice thing, and it was completely innocent on my part. And it was, and they just welcomed me, and then, okay, we'll feed you. You know, it's...
that's amazing.
It's unreal.
It was so cool.
But that's just the beauty of the bike, you know. Yeah. I think that, you know, I think if you had a normal bike, they probably would have done it as well. But it's just
that brings down barriers.
Yeah, it does huh? Totally. You know,
absolutely.
You know, it's a cool thing to have with you. Yeah. Just for those reasons.
Do you have any big adventures planned now? Do you have something that you're trying to tick off still?
Well, I mean, the big one I'd like to, because I've never been to Africa. So I'd like to do the Noordkapper to South Cape of South Africa.
Right.
So it's another multi-year trip.
Wow.
And you'd
have to plan that well, right? Because isn't it, I mean, just in that it can be quite dangerous in places or not?
It changes all the time.
Yeah.
By the time you start a trip, by the time you get to somewhere, it might be dodgy. It might be fine there.
Yeah, that's true.
By the time you get there.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Ask the locals. That's the thing. Yeah. Don't read the press, because they, you know, it's just going to be nonsense. You know, it's...
That's right. You're right, you know, there as well. You're right.
Ask the locals and work your way through. You know, it's on the second round the world one, going down through South America, big care from Mexico. Mexico was amazing. Mm. There's such lovely people.
Yeah, they are.
And they feel... I can imagine, and the ones I spoke to feel a bit insulted that yes, there is this bad part of the country, but it's no, we're just what? Nice
a lot
people.
Of them are really
they're lovely.
Embarrassed about the history, actually. Yeah,
I think it's like you said that there's bad people everywhere.
Exactly.
In the world,
yeah.
You know?
And it's, I mean, and further down from there, when I got to Costa Rica, and I could have gone through Panama, and there's the Darien Gap, which is the kind of big one to try and get through, and it was the wrong season. It's like, oh, I can't, I'm not going to try and get it through the Darien Gap there. And
what is the Darien Gap? A mountain
like pass? No, it's like 90 between Panama and Colombia. It's about 90 kilometers like of swampy jungle. There's no roads that go through there.
What?
And so you can't get through. You have to either fly over. And they've kind of left it like that, I think, because of all the drugs and stuff.
Yes, I heard about that. It's like a cut-off.
Yeah. And it's,
that's right, you can't drive between...
That's it.
And someone told me about that.
I think in the dry season, it is possible. And FARC in the Colombian side in that area as well. And so it can be dodgy, but... And you go with that intention, I can try and get through. And it was like, no, it's not going to work. So I got the map out and I thought, oh, actually, because it's in Costa Rica. If I go directly east... That's on the line with Caracas in Venezuela. I thought, oh, Venezuela looks good. No one seems to be going there. I'll go to Venezuela. Then I'm not cheating by going any further south. I'm just going east and coming through Venezuela. And that was incredible. That was an amazing experience there, because it was, again, it was cheaper than the cheapest country in the world because of their inflation. And so you just take dollars in with you, and you can live like a king. You know, it's amazing. You just got to change all your money in the black market. And it's
what a life!
And what a life!
It's so cool. I mean, but there's
penny fund.
Yeah.
High denomination notes. So it's all like you end up with like $100. It's like literally piles of money this high. And where'd you put it?
Is that right?
Oh yeah, it's nuts. And one of the times I stopped and to get the money exchange, and I had to stay in a hotel, which is like $1 a night opposite, whilst they were sorting it out. And it was a gold exchange. So it took about 2 or 3 days. And if they finally got the money for me. And it's like, okay, put that in your backpack, the main lot. And he gave me a carrier bag with money in. And he said, when you get robbed, let them take the carrier bag and then you'll keep the money in the back. I was like, well, money crossing the road. He said, yeah. Oh, okay.
honestly.
And it was, but it was fine.
That is so wild.
But
what would you say, like, you've had this crazy life of adventure. What would you say to the people who are like, oh, it sounds amazing, but like, I don't think I could do it.
Oh, like, yes, you can. Yes, you can. I mean, when I meet people on the road, I wish I could do that. Well, why not? Well, I got a good job. Oh, jack it in. Are you good at your job? Yeah, jack it in. You get another job. You know, it's
you're right.
Oh, okay, I've got a house. Great, rent it out. Pays for your trip. There you go. Done. Oh, I've got kids. Take your kids with you. You know, I've met people with kids, you know, young kids in trailers and stuff on the road. Oh. And the kids are amazing.
Yeah.
You know,
it's just like a brilliant, almost nomadic life, isn't it? Once you set off.
Well, you can. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Because it's just, you're just following the wind, and the wind will take you where you're supposed to go. And not always. Sometimes it's trying to stop you from where you want to go as well. But they're not quite so much fun those days. But anyone can do it, really.
Yeah.
Not necessarily with a penny farthing, on a regular bike, or if it's just traveling. Or if your adventure is in something else, just do it. You know, don't let worry about stuff to stop you. I mean, and like, you know, it's like the payment thing. How do you pay for this thing? Work hard, save up, sell everything you own. There you go, done. You know,
I mean, the last part.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, my budget was £5 a day on the Realm of the World trip.
No. Wow, no way.
I went over a bit at the end, but that's it. You can do it. It's just live cheap. You know, it's.
All on a bike you made yourself.
Yeah.
It's even more incredible.
Well, it's mad, but it's kind of, it's great. You know, it's just good fun. You know, it's and you get to see your proper view of the world.
Well, you can get view over hedges on that, right?
Totally,
you see it a lot more.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like being a van driver. Yeah.
Joff, this has been so cool. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
For joining us.
My pleasure. Coming in.
Really,
thanks
appreciate
for inviting.
Thank you.
You're very humble with all the world champions you've been.
Neither of us were ever world champions. Yeah. We'll take it.
Yeah, at least as a world traveler here.
That's right. Thanks, mate.
Yeah. Man, this was a conversation that I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would have.
A bloke who builds his own penny farthing and literally goes anywhere he feels like on planet Earth. Basically, it sounded like guided by the wind only. Well, I mean,
man, okay, so after the podcast, he just kept telling stories.
Yeah, they won't end.
It was like, and I mean, I guess so, like, you ride around the world twice, you sell everything, like years of time on the road.
From getting robbed.
Yeah.
Which would have been the most scary thing ever in the middle of nowhere in Ecuador, to basically running a Chinese lady over. I mean, it was all in there.
Well, what's the helmet? The helmet called?
It looked like something from like, some mothers do have them, which you wouldn't know about. I don't know. It was like, I don't know what that was.
Well, he was telling us a story about it. Like, yeah. So he was like, yeah, it felt good, you know, or it felt appropriate to wear this kind of helmet on here. And, you know, I was riding around. There was like a serendipitous story that he had met somebody. But then, like you said, he was riding, I think, in Thailand.
Yeah.
And there was a what is that called?
Landslide,
and he got impatient. You know, he's like, "Oh, it kept sliding or whatever." He's like, "I gotta go. I got round the worlds to do." And he, as he was walking, like a stone, you know, the size of a cell phone, hit him in the head.
I know, and it's how it saved his life.
It's you can see it. It's a chunk,
and he will not, I don't think, ride that penny farthing without that exact helmet on. Yeah, it's a beautiful. It suits the penny farthing. It's white. It sticks up about 2 feet above his head. I mean, it's it just all adds into the penny farthing experience.
I love that we had Joff on the podcast because
one of the most interesting people I've ever spoke to.
He's not one of those guys who you would, you know, he's this larger than life star, a bunch of followers, super famous, but it shows the range that a bicycle has, you know, even if that bicycle is, you know, popular in the late 1800s, it doesn't matter.
He knows all about them.
Yeah.
He knew the history of them. But as you say, the bicycle is a beautiful vessel in any way, shape or form. And he has stripped it back there to almost its barest.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The penny farthing. He loves the penny farthing. And we, after meeting him, you can only embrace that.
Totally.
You can it's just I loved his love of penny farthings and what he does on them. It was just, you know, this incredible engineer that he is. and he goes for the simplest.
Yeah.
He loves that, the simplest bicycle that's ever been made.
Well, maybe I'll ride around the world. Well,
you need a bit of practice first.
Okay. Well, let us know. Let me know if I should try to ride around the world on a mini farthing.
just yes, everyone. Yes.
Hit us up, podcast@redbull.com. Let us know in our socials. Leave us a comment, a message. And I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say.
I'm really interested. We could peer group pressure him into this show. We really could. And don't forget, there's new episodes of Just Ride every other Tuesday, available to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to watch us too, all these full-length episodes are on Red Bull TV or redbull.com.
And I'll see you on a penny farthing.